My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Welcome to Going in Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell, and my guest this week, I'm pretty positive, has just a little bit wrong with him. He, in 2019, he won the 6633 Arctic Ultra in Canada in February, I might add. So my math comes out to the fact that, you know, 380 miles plus those temperatures means it's a whole lot of hell in a probably a rather short amount of time. But in 2023, he also placed second in the Laplandian Ultra in Sweden, which was another 300 plus mile race. And by the time this thing comes out, he will have headed to the deserts of Namibia for another ultra. And I cannot begin to comprehend what makes a person like that tick. So I'm sure we're going to get into all sorts of new territory here on this episode, and very excited about it. But before we do, a couple quick announcements. You guys have already heard me talk about my memoir that's on the way. If you don't know why I'd be writing a memoir or need to know a little bit more about my background, just head over to my website at zachtidwell.com. You can read a little bit about all that there, and also join the mailing list to get announcements about when it is going to be out on the world wide web for sale and get some deals for pre-ordering and all that stuff. Can also, last little thing here, the best way to help me grow this show and ensure that I keep getting incredible guests like this to come on is to spread the word. And whether that's through word of mouth or by leaving a rating and review wherever you're listening, or now that these are available as video episodes, head on over to YouTube and see what we have going on there. But without any further ado, please welcome Mr. Paul Watkins. How are you,
Paul? Isaac, how am I?
Pretty good, man. Sorry, the whole thing new with the videos and not being able to, like, making people listen to me while I'm doing their intros has been weird. So I'm still figuring it out, but because
It's not the first time someone said this guy's done this stuff and I think he's broken. So it's not the first time someone's introduced me that way. Going, there's something wrong with this guy. Let's find out.
Yeah. Oh, when I was just doing audio, I was very intentional, I guess, as I kind of found my groove to try and cut out the small talk in the beginning of, hey, how are you? Thanks for coming on. But this kind of impedes my ability to remove that because I can't edit the video for the very beginning, but we'll be all right. So
it's real and natural. I think that's okay. A little bit of banter at the start. It lets people know that we're just human beings. I think it's good. I think it's all right. It's a good time.
That's fair. People get to hear your sweet accent, so that's always good. But
I don't have an accent. What do you mean?
Yeah. Dude, I don't even know where to begin with all this because I want to pick your brain on some of the entrepreneurial ventures that you've had too. But I feel like I need to scratch my curiosity first. I don't understand what leads someone down that path to what you achieved in 2019. And then obviously it seems like this has become an integral part of your life, considering you keep training for these freaking things. So maybe start with what led you towards taking on that ultra in 2019.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think it's a really important one because you don't just wake up one day and go, you know, 614 kilometers or 383 miles in the Arctic in the end of winter sounds like a good idea. Like, you iterate through to that point. So to go back a long way, I spent probably 20 years getting to the point where doing that race seemed like a logical next step. And the very first step at the other end of that 20 years was something very, very minor. I was, I'm a nerd by training. I'm not a supreme athlete. I don't have any gifted genetic skills. I don't have a massive VO2 max or anything. I'm a nerdy guy who was running businesses and was hideously overworked. And wanted to get a little bit of escapism for that, to try and get some kind of balance back in any way, shape, or form in my life. And the only sport I had any capacity at was running. So I just got into running. So you got back and you do a 5K and then you do a 10K, you do a half marathon, and just kind of iterated my way up. And at one point I decided I wanted to go away and do something that was outside my real zone of normal stuff. And I went and did a trek in Papua New Guinea, which is just off the north coast of Australia here. The jungle track made famous in World War II, called the Kokoda Track. It's 96 kilometers thick jungle. And I wanted to go do it as a respect to my grandfather who fought near there in World War II. So I wanted to go there and retrace his footsteps and try and get an understanding of what it was he went through there as a 18-year-old kid in World War II. But out of that journey, I really went, oh, that made me feel really like a human being. Like, I felt really different. And you're allowed to do these things, even if on paper you're not qualified to do it because you're a nerdy pharmacist guy. What else could I do? So then I just iterated, what's the next slightly harder thing I could do? And so I went and did some basic climbing in New Zealand. Well, what's the next hardest thing? And you just iterate up. And I just did that for a decade and got to the point where I was ended up doing really, really big high altitude mountains. So I climbed, I did a season in the Antarctic. I climbed in North America, did Denali twice, South America, Africa, Himalayas a few times. And reached a point where I was climbing the big stuff where things have a propensity to go horrendously wrong. And when you're young and you're single, you can push the chips in all the time. You can go all in every hand and that's okay. But as you get older, you get married and then you start having kids and you realize that all the chips aren't yours anymore. You have responsibilities. So I hung up the climbing boots because I was on expeditions where not everyone was making it home from expedition groups. I went, well, I don't need that level of risk, but I still need to scratch that itch of what am I capable of? Like, how deep is the well? And went back to, okay, I've got skill set that I can go really long distances hauling heavy loads for very long periods of time. Where can I use that? And it turns out there's a thing like really long expedition ultra marathons, particularly cold weather ones. So I found these races that you could do and went, well, that would be the next logical step for me. So it sounds insane when you go, oh, you went and did a 383 miler in the, you know, Canadian Arctic at the end of winter, kind of, you know, spring bridge, hauling your own gear, fully self-sufficient for 9 days. But it was a 20-year road to get to that point. And I think it's easy, particularly in the age of social media, to forget that. Like, there's a long arc of really hard work, peppered with a fair degree of failures and screw-ups that allowed me to get to the point where that became the next logical thing. It still seems insane to people, I don't understand that. But for me, it was a long arc.
It is. I expected there to be a long arc there, especially because of you already said, you know, I'm not a standout athlete, but you mentally, you do have to be just an anomaly to be able to do that. But that's also not something that you're born with, like that drive and that discipline and whatever that freaking extra probably six gears that you have in your brain is something that we now know, like research has shown that is something that we forge over time through doing progressively harder things and continuously subjecting ourselves to hard things. So I was kind of curious because I've had some adventurers and athletes on here, but nothing to this extent, and in specifically in the endurance realm. One of my buddies, actually, he's been on the show before. His name is Lonnie Bedwell. He's completely blind, and he is getting ready to finish the Adventurers Grand Slam. He just climbed the two tallest peaks in Australia, and then that's his... He's got the South Pole, he's got seven peaks, and now he's there. And I know, obviously for him, that was a long time getting there, but like, this is just, even that is very, it's still a very different lane than you going and doing this kind of crazy shit. And it's just, I think it's important for people to hear that it is a long road. Like you said, people do seem to forget that. And I think we even see that with simpler things in life, whether it be, you know, I did it a lot with stuff with coming back from after my suicide attempt, and then the blindness, like the things that I've pulled off. And I know Lonnie gets it when it comes to stuff with all the mountaineering and the other like huge accomplishments that he's had as an adventurer. And it's, I wanted to pull that out of you and also maybe get you to talk, see if that would pull out the mindset piece. Cause I know that's inherently part of all of the things that you've done, but that is also some of what you do today professionally too, is speaking to that. But maybe we can come back to that later. Cause you mentioned with that first, the first trek in Papua New Guinea, was that self-supported too?
No, that was like a guided tour. That like was really, okay. I went over to Rebel, which is in New Britain, near New Guinea, on my own, and just kind of retraced where my grandfather had been. And I just did that solo, and then did like a guided trek. So the Kokoda track's great. You can do it with a guide. And particularly what I did was go with a historical guide. So someone who can actually walk you through and give you context of what happened in this place at that time, and to kind of paint that picture for you, which really added a lot of context and understanding around that. So that trip was a very specific purpose of going, I want to come here and understand what happened here, and try and get some empathy for what my grandfather had been through and what all his mates went through when they were here. And that was absolutely mind expanding for me to sit there and go, for me, just hauling a pack through 96 kilometers of tropical jungle was incredibly hard. No one was trying to kill me though. Like I was just there, you know, I'd get a can of Coke at the village when we got there. No one was trying to wipe out my existence. So I had the easiest way possible. So that was really important. But then, and I think your point about mindset is kind of the crux to the whole thing of going, the other adventures I've done have really been about discovering what are you capable of. And people go, how did you wake up one day and just...
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Decide that you could do something that ridiculous. And my answer is always, well, because of the last previous ridiculous thing that I did. Like you build evidence over time and it starts really small. How did you think you could run a half marathon? Well, I ran 10Ks or I ran 15Ks or whatever it is. So you start to build this body of evidence that says that you are the kind of person who might be able to do the next hardest thing. And it's not based on woo magic or saying your mantra or, you know, listening to all your Tony Robbins tapes or whatever you have to do.
Manifesting it.
Yeah. I'm not going to manifest it out of zero. Like it's just a case of going, well, I have evidence. So when it gets really, really hard, you can remind yourself, hey, remember the last hard thing? You did that. So you're the kind of person that can actually do some hard things. So how about you bring that guy back into the game and move forward and see if you can do the next hardest thing. And it doesn't guarantee you the win. You often, you know, there's plenty of failures in there as well. But as you spend time and build that evidence that you're the kind of person, you build this huge body of work that you can rely on when it gets very, very, very hard. And yes, there's a competitive mental athlete aspect to it as well of going, I want to know how far I can dig. And for me, I'm not the fastest athlete ever, but I will outwork almost anyone. Like if it's really, really long, particularly these events, which are single stage, so you don't stop overnight. Like the clock's on 24/7 and we start the race at 9 a.m. Monday and you've got 10 days and you can run 24 hours a day if you want, but the clock's always on. So it was just a case of I can generally outwork people. I'm not the fastest, but I can go for longer than anyone else. And when you get that, over the longer haul of those races, that tends to be where I excel.
And I think that's interesting. And maybe my mental picture of this is wrong, but I would imagine you get even 12 hours into that race and there's no other participants in sight at that point. Like it is you. And so like, yes, you are being competitive, but like, and you're outworking them, but you don't know where everyone's at. You don't, is that the case?
No idea. That's absolutely the case. Yeah. So, wow. For example, that Laplandian one that I did in Sweden, so that's 500K, so 300 miles. I would have spent, 260 of those miles completely alone. And in some of these races, by alone, as in you don't see a human being for ages, days. Like there's no one in front of you, there's no one behind you. And it's not, the problem isn't the 12-hour in, it's day four, day five, day six, you're hallucinating, you're frozen, you're way under caloried, you're still dragging the sled. So we're self-sufficient. So we've got about a 25 kilo sled that has enough food to last you for the 10 days, all your survival gear, a bivy bag to sleep in, your little stove and your thermoses of water or what have you. See, it's really hard when you get to those day four and five and your body's packed it in and your brain hates you. You hate everything. Everything's a disaster. Everything's difficult. You have the IQ of a small rock. Like everything is difficult, Everything is difficult. But yeah. That's when it comes down to how disciplined were you both in your preparation and then in your execution. Like really silly things. Like we had a sled bag that has all the gear in it with these races. So I had a rule that whenever you opened or closed the bag, the zips had to go back to exactly the middle, which sounds really, OCD, but it means that on day five, when you can't see properly and you're hallucinating and your hands are frozen, and like I said, you're an idiot, I don't have to figure out where the zips were and crack the sads because I can't find them. They're exactly in the same spot every time. And the food in your bag is in the same spot every time. And the water is in the same spot every time. And your spork is in the same spot every time. So that you can be efficient. It takes the minimum mental load and you get the job done and you're moving again before anybody else is kind of in and out of the checkpoints or just taking their time to have their meals or whatever. So it really was building that discipline in training. And then having the discipline to execute it when it actually matters most. And I actually find that really fascinating as a scientist to go, how good can a human being get at this? Like, how far can we go? So I really enjoy the science-y aspect of just, A, how deep can I get? And then B, also kind of watching yourself third person as you kind of disintegrate over the course of the race and go, this is fascinating. When I start to hallucinate in these big races, a part of my brain is like, this is incredible. You're falling apart. This is really interesting. Let's watch this guy just devolve into a rock and see what happens.
You're probably at some point, I would imagine you're almost having like a psychedelic experience just from the exhaustion and the isolation. Like, I don't know. Go ahead.
Well, put that in context. So in that Sweden race, one of the issues with sleep, I have a sleep strategy for these events. So when it's a race that long, so I know I'm going to be racing for over a week nonstop. My sleep strategy is generally a short nap, like 20 minutes in the bivy bag mid-morning, 20 minutes, half an hour, mid-afternoon, and about 40 minutes at night. And that's it. That's what you get every day, 7 days a week until the job's done. And I'm very disciplined, as in when you're going to have a sleep, you've got 90 seconds to stop, get the bivy bag out, sort yourself out and be in. And when the alarm goes off, you've got 90 seconds up, dressed, gear on, sled moving, we're gone. Because if it's not 90 seconds, it's 4 hours because you're staying in the bag.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with the Sweden race is that you couldn't sleep wherever you wanted. Like in the Canadian Arctic, if you wanted to sleep, you just kind of pulled over the side of the trail and got your bivy bag out. But in Lapland, we're on a very old snowmobile trail. And the race director said, look, it's the chances of someone on a snowmobile coming through at 2 a.m. is almost zero. But it's not zero, so that you can't sleep on the trail. If you want to sleep, you must get well off and find a place that's safe to sleep. And it's super deep snow. So sometimes even if you wanted to sleep, you couldn't. So I had to push way, way, way past what I expected to need to do in terms of sleep deprivation. So to get to the point of the story, about 3 or 4 days in, I came to the realization that there was a woman following me. Like I was convinced 100%, would bet my life on it, that there was a woman following me. I couldn't see
raising.
Her. I didn't know who she was, but I knew she was there to help me. Like I was comforted by the fact that she was there. And to the point where if I did sleep, I would wake up and my first thought would be, oh my God, is she okay? You didn't check that she is okay. Or if I made a freeze-dried meal to eat, I would get halfway through it and then go, you didn't offer any food. Just so rude. Check if she needs food. And then you realize that she's not there. So I got home and I told my wife this. I'm like, you're not going to believe it. I reckon there was a lady following me, like, some weird Swedish forest sprite woman. I don't know. Anyway, she found an article and gave it to me months later and said, oh, this is what happened. And it's called the third man effect. And apparently Arctic explorers used to get this. And what happens is when your brain figures out that you're pushed way past the limits of safety, like we're in deep, deep trouble here, it will manifest a third person. It will create a fake person to give you comfort and to keep you going. So my brain said, hey, there's a lady here who's here to help you. So you're going to be okay, but you must keep going. You can't stop. But we're going to be okay because there's someone here and they're here to help you and you're not alone and it's going to be okay. So when your brain figures out that you're right on the edge of what, you know, your body's going to be able to do before you fall over and car crash, it will manifest as third person. So that was when I knew that I had absolutely pushed the extreme limit of what you can do in terms of not sleeping, but still moving, like still maintaining a forward pace. So I was still walking flat stick 22, 23 hours a day, 7 days a week, which meant I crushed my step count. Absolutely crushed. I was hitting over 100,000 steps a day, no problems at all. Absolutely crushing it. So, you know, Fitbit, I got some bonuses out of it.
Sending you all sorts of Fitbit notifications like, you're killing it.
Yeah, my Garmin's melting going, what are you doing, man? Stop. So, yeah, but part of me is fascinated by it. I'm sure it's not healthy. I'm sure I've Swiss cheesed my brain to some degree in doing that. But I find it fascinating as a scientist to go, you know, you think the well is so deep in terms of what you're capable of. And my fear would be that you spend your whole life thinking your well is only 6 foot deep and it's actually 30 foot deep. Like you've got so much capacity that most people never even have the chance to tap into. I love these events because it allows me to go to the well, go all the way to the bottom of the well and then dig and dig and dig and see how far can I actually go before I hit a wall that I simply cannot get through. And it turns out, like, even if you're a normal person, you can go a long, long way. So that's kind of my take on that.
But even in your extent, you know, it's, that seems like it is literally pushing your body to the point, like your mind is so strong that you are pushing your body to the point where it is probably dying by the last days of that race. I don't know how it wouldn't be even. You said the sled's about 25 kilos, right?
Yep.
Like that's lighter than I would have expected. Not from the food standpoint, but just the amount of water that you must be pushing for something like that.
I'd carry 5 liters of water. And that would either get me from there were checkpoints and the checkpoints, okay, they guaranteed two things. They'd said we'd get you hot water, providing the winter fuel mix hadn't frozen. So if they're frozen, it's tough, like you don't get anything. And they said, we'll get you out of the wind. But by get you out of the wind, that might mean like some of them were a community hall. If you went through like a little First Nation and hamlet or something like that, but it might also be Steve's here with his car or Zach's got his trailer here and you can get in his trailer for 10 minutes or that's it. Like that's all we can offer you. And you had part of the mandatory gear was a small stove. So if you needed more water, you just stopped, melt snow and bingo, you've got water. So I would keep about 5 liters of fluid water on me at any one time. And 25 kilos, like that was me getting the sled as alive as I could. So that's like, I will wear one pair of jocks for the entire week. Like we will have the minimum of everything without getting silly from a safety standpoint or mandatory gear standpoint. But I would make sure that everything was light as possible. And to put into context in terms of the toll on your body, so I was trying to eat around 6,000 calories a day. So I was eating pretty much constantly and I wasn't far off hitting that, but I still dropped 10 kilos or 22 pounds from start to finish in a week, even eating 6,000 calories a day. So
probably
that's not health advice, people. Don't do that. It's not a great weight loss plan. Asterisk, do not do this. But yeah, in terms of just, you're just a calorie incinerator because you've got to keep warm. It's minus 38 or minus 40. So that's the same in Fahrenheit as it is in centigrade. The graphs cross. So minus 40 is the same for both. You just chew through calories just to stay warm and alive, let alone drag a sled and keep up a pace and make decisions and do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And at that point, I mean, are your bottom layers just wool and are you even able to stop and change your socks because of how cold it is?
No, well, I only brought 2 pairs of socks because that's weight. So you just have minimum socks. I did pretty well. So I would have a thin pair of socks and a thick pair of socks. I did it in like Hoka Gore-Tex runners. Like you didn't have to have any special boots. Like they were warm enough for me. I tolerate the cold relatively really well. Maybe through experience, I'm very good at understanding how I respond to the cold. And bottom layers, you'd have a thermal layer and then have a kind of a mid layer of pants and then an outer layer of what I call the nuclear option for when it got absolutely horrendously howling cold and you've got to put on everything. And top layer is just layer after layer after layer. Like quite often I'd have like 8 or 9 layers on my top of like, you know, thin, thin, medium. At some points there, I had 3 full down jackets on at once, plus beanies and everything on, and I was still cold. Just because if it's minus 40 and it's absolutely howling, you know, you can wear everything. It doesn't matter. At some points, there was a point in one of those races where I went, okay, if it gets any worse, I will literally tip everything out of my sled bag and get into the sled bag because that's relatively windproof and just zip it up, put a flag up, hit my safety like Garmin InReach emergency button and go, find me here. Look for the flag sticking up in the snow. Please come and get me. So there are times when you're like, and then part of, even when that happened, even when I'm like, wow, this has got as bad as it's going to get, part of my brain went, at least you're getting value for money. Like you're getting the full ticket ride here. You're getting the full experience. So there was still a part of my brain that went, this is kind of cool. Like you're going to have a really cool story for this. Like, you know, at least you didn't turn up and it was sunny. You wanted it. Here it is.
I bet like who knows how minuscule of it is in the equation, but I bet that ability to view things like that is at least a tiny part of the equation of you being able to push yourself like that. Like that seems.
I think it's a huge part of the equation.
Yeah.
I think it's a massive part of the equation. The ability to gets to the point where you can actually laugh about it. It's so bad, it's actually laughable. Like you look at some of the stuff you're dealing with and go, this is hilarious. Like it's so bad, it's actually funny. And I think that quite often you get that. I mean, I'm sure you would have seen this as well. You get that dark humor, that kind of really dark humor camaraderie that people get in difficult times. And it actually is a survival mechanism and like a defense mechanism to allow you to deal with the insanity of whatever you're attempting to do or attempting to get through. So I actually think that's really, really important. You're right to point it out, but I don't think it's minuscule. I think it's huge.
Yeah. That's the dark humor thing is definitely. I mean, you see that a lot in the military. That is regardless of how miserable this is, like somebody's going to find a way to laugh about it at some point. And I do. But again, you're not doing it alone. Operators would be, you know, like a SEAL or a Delta Force guy might be out there doing shit alone. But like, I was just a normal infantryman. You're not doing anything alone. If you're alone and unafraid, that's bad news that you've gotten to the point where you're alone. Like you're not supposed to be at that point.
You're not meant to be alone. That's a problem.
Yeah, you're supposed to. The idea is you've at least got a battle buddy with you at some point. Not if you're down to one. That's doesn't mean good things for anybody. But it's interesting. Like you've said several things that have made me think back. So I guess with your experience on that trail, kind of retracing the steps of your grandfather, it's not necessarily the same thing, but both of my deployments were in the Pacific and spent time in the jungle in Okinawa. And it was very similar, you know, like especially, you know, Marines shed a lot of blood on those islands and like being in the jungle in there, that is. The jungle is the most miserable place I've ever been in my life. Despise it. And I was just like in awe of the idea that they were men hard enough in the 1940s with leather boots, no real technology to any of the gear or the clothing that they're wearing or anything like that in this wet peanut butter hills of, you know, the underbrush of, I mean, that's what it is. That's what the under the canopy in the jungle is it's peanut butter rocks and hills everywhere. And it's just, you know, even then, like that was very, I would say like a formative like realization for me almost in thinking back to that and trying to like also realizing like, man, I'm a pussy. Those were hard dudes. But
yep.
that's what made me ask about the socks and stuff too. Cause you know, I've had my feet rotting off after time in the jungle or even just after.
Oh, trench foot. Yeah.
It's just, you know, not like clinical trench foot, but just to the point of where, the soles of my feet were pretty much gone, like after you spend a week out there or whatever. And it's just, It's even you mentioned like the way that you pack things and very intentional. Like that's because you weren't in the military, right?
No, okay. Military background at all.
So with all that stuff, like even you learning how to pack things and being able to, that's very similar to how we would approach being able to do things in the dark. You shouldn't need a light for anything. You should always know where all of your stuff is, even in your ruck that has 60 pounds of shit in it. You need to know where everything is. And it's, were you reading about stuff like that? Was that just, I know, again, there was a long timeline there. So were you just tinkering? Like how did you become aware of all those practices and that you've kind of employed through all this stuff?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I think the most important point of that is I was really shit at it to begin with. And I just learned by looking at guys who were really, really good at it and going, wow, I'm absolutely shit at this. Why is he so good at it? And then just learning and learning and learning. And just so like I've in all the tricks and all the tips and everything that I use for every event, I have invented none of it. I have borrowed, begged, stolen all of it from other people. So like just little tips and tricks along the way. Like, you know, I've with a lot of these events, you often get quite a lot of military types on there. So you see how these guys operate. You see how they pack. You see how they execute. You see how they handle themselves and those kind of things. And even like some of the big mountaineering expeditions. I always remember once I was on an expedition and the lead guide who just had a huge back catalogue of massive mountains and stuff. I'm like, how are you so calm? Like, how do you do this? Like, I'm panicking about, you know, my overheating, my underheating, if I had enough food or I had enough hydration, my pack feels weird, blah, blah, blah. And he said, I'm only worried about one thing. He said, when I put my boot down, I'm trying to not dislodge a pebble. I'm trying to place my foot, not dislodge anything, and then place the next foot. And he said, I'm trying to have about a second rest between every step. He said, that's all I think about. And that's it. And really, this guy was like, at that point, he was one of the hardest people I knew. And I'm like, you're very zen about it. You're not trying to be a hero. You're not trying to beat the mountain. You're not trying to win anything. You're just being very calm and intentional about how you move. And he looked like he's expending no energy. And I looked like I'd run a marathon every three steps. I'm like, right. Okay. That's how you do it. Right. You need to think differently. So you take all those little pieces from people who are really, really good at it and you start building your own toolkit of, I need to pack better. I need to know where my things are. You know, when your brain starts to betray you and think crazy things, because it will, because it's a brain and you're human, how do I get that under control? How do I breathe? What do I think about? Where do I go to for these things? So you build the toolkit over time. So it's taken me, like I said, 20 years of doing this kind of stuff to get to the point where I can pack and prep one of these things quite quickly and I know how to execute quite quickly. But, I mean, as you see with operators, like it's you drill it and you drill it and you drill it until it doesn't matter. So that for me, when the alarm goes off and you're in the bivy bag in the Arctic, it's 90 seconds and you're up and you're done and you go. Or if you hit a problem that you haven't hit before, you don't panic. You're okay. What do we need to solve here? What's the small thing that I need to solve? I need to fix this. Okay, we'll solve that. And what's the next problem? Okay, solve that. And you just find a way to do it. So a good example of that, which terrifies people, at the end of that Sweden race on the last night, I was so sleep deprived that I was losing my understanding, like my vision was kind of going. So I wasn't going blind, but I couldn't figure out. Yeah, I wasn't going blind, but I couldn't figure out what was up or down or left or right. So I would be walking and all of a sudden it would feel like the trail was in the sky and the sky was on the ground. And like it was almost as if my brain just said, look, if you don't stop, we'll just turn you off. We'll just switch you off and then you'll have to stop. So obviously I couldn't move because I had no understanding of where to put my foot. So I went, okay, I need to solve this. It's on the last night, so I'm pushing. I'm in second place. I know I can't catch the guy coming first. I know the guy coming third is hammering along behind me. I can't stop. What do I do? So I figured out, going, okay, well, if I grab my phone, I put a seven-minute timer on my phone. I just guessed that would be enough. And you shove it behind your neck in the inside your down jacket because it's really uncomfortable there. I'd unclip my harness, and I knew if I took three steps back, I'd hit my sled. Lie down on your sled, start the 7-minute timer, and you just go to sleep because you're so tired, you're asleep in a second. And my alarm would go off 7 minutes later and you'd get up and you'd cleared enough that you could see, like your visual senses would work. I'm like, okay, the ground's there, the sky's there, that's left, that's right, cool. And I could get going again. And I'd last for about 90 minutes before everything would shut down again and I couldn't see properly. So, okay, stop, 7 minute timer, hit the sled, get up. And I just did that for 12 hours straight. Just do that until the sun comes up. The sun comes up and your brain goes, oh, it's daytime. All right, you can function a little bit. That's okay. So again, you learn how to go, you don't panic. You just go, oh, we've hit a problem because we're going to hit 1,000 of these. That's okay. Here's today's problem. How do I solve this? What tools do I have in the toolkit? And you just dig through and you find what tools you've got and then you find a way to solve the problem and then you move forward until you get to the next problem. And then you have to solve that. And if you keep solving the problems, eventually you get to the finish line. Now for me, it's like an equation to solve. What are the problems? How do I solve them? How do I get to the end? And that for me is, I find the joy in the process of doing that, of solving the problems as we go.
Yeah, but it almost sounds like, is this accurate that you're almost breaking it down to the simplest level at every point that you can in that process?
Absolutely. Yeah. What's the smallest and easiest thing I can do now that moves the needle in the direction I needed to go and do that and then do that? That's a quote I tell people all the time. Just what's the smallest and easiest thing you can do now that moves the needle in the direction you needed to go? Do that. And then do that again. And then do it again and do it again. And eventually you go, holy shit, we've moved a long way.
For 7 days.
Just do it constantly. But sometimes it really is that simple. Like a race like that, when you look at it in totality, it is an incredibly complex undertaking. But when you break it down very simply, and I spend a lot of time on spreadsheets and stuff because I'm a nerd at the start of a race, it's like, okay, well, what do you need to do? Well, I need to eat. Well, how many calories do you need? Well, how fast are you going to go? So you figure out, I can hold that pace. I'll burn this many calories. I need to eat this many calories. Okay, how can you eat that? What's not going to freeze or be impossible to eat or you can't stomach it? And so you break it all the way down until you go, okay, I now know I need 3 of them, 4 of those and 6 of those. I need to cut them up, put them in a bag. That's 1,000 calories. I need to eat one of those every couple of hours. I need that, do this, do this. And then, okay, that's my calories taken care of. That's that problem solved. And you just work your way through, prepare for as much as you can, solve all those problems that you know about, and then be prepared to solve the unknown problems when they turn up. Like, you know, one night in that, in the 6633, I was traveling with another Aussie. We'd caught up and we're just traveling along and the wheels on his sled, the axle snapped because it's so cold. The metal, the aluminium quite often on the poles would just simply shatter. And you're like, okay. So it's like 2 o'clock in the morning, it's minus 40. And we've got his sled upside down on the Dempster Highway, which is the ice road truckers highway. And there's the two of us with a head torch and a Leatherman going, all right, we've got 3 zip ties, a piece of wire we found and a bit of tape, and we need to fix this. So let's figure that out. And figure it out because there's no one there. No one's coming to help you. You're going, you can quit, but you don't want to quit. So you're like, okay, we have to solve this. So let's solve it. And you just find a way. Because the alternative is that you're out and it's over and we didn't want to accept that outcome. So you solve the problem.
Would you have helped him if he wasn't another Aussie?
Yeah, I would have.
did he finish the race?
And at that point, he'd already saved my ass. Actually, to put context in that story, we'd got into it. I'd done that, the 6633, I've done it twice. Well, I should say 1.5 times. And the first time I did it, I failed. I DNF'd about halfway. But the first time I did it, I got to the first checkpoint, which is 113 kilometers in. So what's that? Probably about 75, 80 miles in. And I was done. I was going to quit. I was horrified. I'd had the living daylights beaten out of me. This is so hard. No one could ever do this. This is ridiculous. And Tim, that other Aussie, said to me, he said, oh, when are you going out? Like, how long are you going to be in the checkpoint for? I'm like, I'm done. I'm not leaving here. Like, that's it. He's like, well, hang on, mate. Haven't you figured this out? Like, it's not a race. It's just a survival event. The goal is to see how far you can get. So he's like, I've got a thermos of this. You got a thermos of that. Why don't we go together? And we'll just keep an eye on each other. Now, he thought nothing of that. He just thought, oh, I'm just reaching out to a mate going, hey, you okay? And the mate, being me, said no. And he said, well, hang on, let me help you out. We'll go together and we'll keep going. And if he hadn't asked me that, I would have quit 100%. I would have quit at that checkpoint. But he asked me that and he got me out of that. And we kept going, and that's when his sled broke and we fixed it. But I kept going for nearly another 200 kilometers. Wow. And that experience was enough for me to go home, even though I failed, to go home and go, I think there's a way through this. I learned enough in the failure to understand what a successful event would look like. Like, okay, it looks like the opposite of what I just did, but I now know what that actually means. Yeah. So I learned enough. Like if I'd quit at the 100K mark, I would never have gone back. I would have gone, this is impossible. Can't do it. It's bullshit. But he kept me in the game long enough to learn enough that even though I failed, I got home with enough knowledge to go, I think there's a way to thread the needle on this. And I saw how the guys that did finish, what did they do? How did they do that? What was in their kit? How heavy was their sled? A lot lighter than mine. Like you just see all those kind of things and figure that out. And that gave me the opportunity to come back. And when I went back the second time, I didn't intend to win it. It turned out that I did win it because I executed better than anybody else. But that wasn't my intention. My intention was simply to finish. But, you know, you put the pieces together and you execute it as best you can. Some days, you know, the light shines on you and away you go. So, that was a long way of answering. I would have helped anybody because, and I lead this in the mountains too. The guides have told me, like, everyone has a shit day. So when someone's having a shit day and they're snappy and they're grumpy and they're cracking it and nothing's working, you help them because tomorrow that'll be you. You have your shit day. Everyone gets a shit day in the mountains. So we help each other because everyone takes a turn. And you learn that very, very quickly because when it's your day, you're like, wow, this is a really shit, like nothing is going my way. Everything's gone wrong. And people help you. And then you go, that's how it works. Cool. So when they're having the shit day, yeah, I'll carry some of your gear, mate. I'll do this. Have some of my stuff. It doesn't matter because tomorrow you'll do that for me. So yeah, there was that camaraderie that you get of going, we're all in the suck. So everyone takes a turn and everyone helps everyone out because we all just want to get through. And I've seen guys that have turned up and done the whole, I'm here to win and screw you all. And it never ends well for them. And everyone else has a great experience because they're there together, even if they're competing. But for the people who are just trying to lone wolf it and just don't hand out the help, I think they've missed the entire point of why they were there in the first place or what they could have got out of the experience in the first place.
Yeah, they're definitely missing a huge, huge part of it. And that there's that commiserating, that is like an incredibly human experience for whatever reason. Like it is. It's kind of absurd that we bond over that as when you stop and think about it, the fact that push it, I mean, just why, you know, that you're going against the reason that your body will be, or even your mind will try and be a bitch in things is because it is still a survival machine. It is still measuring, okay, I'm breaking down. You're consuming way more calories than we should. I want to be storing this as fat, you know, whatever. There, we are still that mechanism. And for some reason, what is that about these descendants of chimps that now we've passed that point to where we still have that in us, but on the other side of it, when you get into something, and I guess it doesn't have to be anything nearly to the degree of what you've done, even just being in a miserable, especially I think when it's a willful misery, like you've chosen to subject yourself to that, or at least on some level have had a choice of being in there. Like what is, that is weird that we bond over that.
Yeah, but I think there's two things in that. It's a really good point. One is there's that chosen suffering, like you chose to suffer through this. But I always argue that the chosen suffering allows you to handle the unchosen suffering. Like everyone gets a turn of the stuff that you didn't want, you didn't ask for, and you never chose. And if you've gone through the chosen suffering, you are much better equipped to handle the unchosen stuff that everyone cops at some point. So it better prepares you for those things. And that's where I think there's some value. And the other thing I think, without getting too deep and philosophical about it, I think for 99% of the population, the idea of, oh, you're pushing too hard or it's too much, that bar has gone so out of whack that it's actually nowhere near too hard or too much. Like it's not even, it's the barest amount of discomfort is, whoa, this is too much, you know, I'm struggling with this. When in reality, they're 1% into their well and they've got 99% still in the bag that they could use. And if you put it in a context, it's not athletic, so it helps people look at it from a different lens. Mm. If people think about it from a work context, when you reflect on times at work or the teammates that you remember the most or the people you bonded with, you remember the times it was hard. Remember that project we had to stay up all night and do and the client was a pain in the ass and it was really difficult. Like you never reminisce and talk about the days when you went to work and it was calm and the emails were under control and nothing happened. Like no one cares. But you talk about the stuff where it was really hard because that's where you derive a sense of value and maybe a sense of pride. And, oh, look, Isaac, we did that together. We remember that. That was insane. We were up like three nights doing that proposal for whoever and it was really hard. That's stuff you remember because that's the stuff where you get a sense of value. So I think if you're not pushing the envelope of whatever that envelope looks like for you, if you're not doing that regularly, you're robbing yourself of a whole stack of human experience and a whole stack of stories and a whole stack of respect for yourself to go, we did that. Remember that? We actually did that. And then, yeah, you're the kind of person that can do that. I wonder what else you could do. So I think that that bonding mechanism in some ways might be a signal to you that you are capable of doing hard things and they are important to you because they are important to you as an organism and to develop yourself and to have capacity, particularly when the unchosen stuff turns up and you go, okay, this is hard, but I've done hard things before. So I can dip into the toolkit and try and find a way through. So yeah, I think it's a really important point as to why we bond over, you know, shitty, horrible things, because it's important.
Yeah, and I wonder, sorry, I'm going to drag you into the philosophical part of this a little bit because I'm
that's
just,
fine, Jeff. I'll go
it's interesting
you want,
to me. And I know you've obviously done a lot of thinking about this. I would imagine, especially as someone who obviously you've lived it, but then you also convey it to other people. So I would imagine you've talked about it more, but you know, do you think that is because we are constantly seeking comfort, right? And that is part of why the people's bar for difficult things gets lower and lower. You know, we have these technologies and whatever other different things in society that do lessen the load, the burden that we have to take on in general, right? And I know generalities are dangerous, but I'm speaking generally just for the sake of this. We're always seeking comfort. And even like I already touched on, our brains are wired to do that still, those survival mechanisms that we have. I think that's where some of that comes from. And some of that is definitely getting hijacked by things, you know, like whether not necessarily in avoiding hard things, but the way that processed food is engineered to play on our, you know, our dopamine receptors, it make it so that
absolutely.
We get addicted to that, or social media is doing the same thing, or whatever. These different, we get different doses of these mechanisms that push buttons for us on our brain, feel good buttons, but we always seek that. I wonder if, or I'll rephrase that, do you think that maybe some of that bonding over the miserable stuff is because it's novel in comparison to our daily lives?
Yeah, I think it's both novel and it's really important. So it's become novel because it never used to be. Like I heard Jimmy Carr talk about this a while ago. He said, like, if you had a hot shower this morning, like you're ahead of like 99.9% of all the people who ever lived in the history of the universe. Like 100 years ago, people didn't have a hot shower. Well, you couldn't just walk in and just turn it on, boom, you got hot showers. So people don't understand the sheer level of luxury that you live in now compared to the entire arc of human history. So the bar of, you know, what you, oh, I didn't get a hot shower this morning. This is terrible. Like the bar, like you said, is the people's bar has been moved so much in terms of what comfort is, so that any hardship has become novel. And I think from a long-term perspective, like people were wired not to be comfortable. If people were wired to just be comfortable, we'd never have left Africa. Like no one would have gone, what's over that hill? And just wandered off and ended up populating the entire planet. Like the point of the exercise is that we wanted to find stuff. We're novel seeking people. So we would go, there's a, you know, a cohort of humans who went, what's over that hill? I want to know what's beyond that. Is there more? Let's go get in a boat and go that way and see what we find. So for a lot of humanity, progress has come from people who didn't want to be comfortable. So that in some ways, I wonder if there's a component from an evolutionary point of view of your brain going, if we stay comfortable, we die here. Like, there's no, we're not going to get anywhere. If we want to find the next step, we need to do uncomfortable things because it unlocks stuff that you're going to need for the next bit. So I think part of it is novelty, and part of it is, I wouldn't be surprised if down the track we find a gene or something in there that says, hey, the level of lack of comfort that you're prepared to tolerate is directly related to how much progress you'll make as a human. Because if you're just full comfort all the time, always, your map that you can operate in will be incredibly small. So you've really limited yourself. If you're like me going, I'll operate anywhere. I really don't care. It doesn't matter. Like, I'll put me in anything. We'll deal with it. The map of where I can operate is limitless. Like, any event, any challenge, whatever, it's now in the wheelhouse of possibility. So for me, that means that the capacity for me as a human being to grow and do stuff is huge. But if you're just all comfort all the time, your map is tiny. And I think you're missing out on just the whole shedload of human experience and progress. There you go. We got into it. We got into the philosophy bit.
But now this is where I like when I get to do this in these conversations. So this is like probably my, you know, doing this podcast has been very just so freaking cool because I get to connect with people that I never would have or even would
have. That goes both ways, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. So like it's been that. And then also it is this kind of stuff that comes out of these conversations. You know, I knew some of your accomplishments. I knew some of your professional background. That's it. I like taking these and seeing where they go. This is why I don't send questions over for anyone. I don't write questions down for myself. I have an idea of different things that I want to talk to someone about. And when we get into this and how people really think and how their experiences have shaped the way that they think and where they get these unique perspectives, like even with you, it seems like, and I talk about this all the time in the context of, you know, mental health and resiliency from that perspective. Shouldn't have used the word perspective there in that context, because the word that I was about to say is what I always say is perspective is everything and it is a choice. But like for you, you've so many of the things that you've said on different levels do boil down to the way that you frame your thinking around things, whether that be mid-event or even I think in the things that you've learned about yourself in doing all of these things and pushing yourself to that point. It's interesting, like you mentioned with the, like we are wired to push ourselves into these uncomfortable places, but I'm also, you know, that touches on like physiologically, we are also structured to do that. That is why the humans are adaptable both mentally and physically to different places and different environments. I'm not a biologist, so I'm speaking way out of turn here, but I think probably better than any other species on this freaking planet. Like I don't know what else can adapt in the way that we can. And that is, I think it speaks to what you're saying, that there is something to that. I wonder, it's like, okay, is that a byproduct of selection over time, you know, genetic selection over time? But it's, I also wonder with what you mentioned about, and I totally agree with what you said on, or in regards to on the human level, if you are not pushing yourself, you know, you are essentially, you are stifling your development. Those are not the words that you used. Those are how I kind of took them in that. So sorry if I'm misquoting you, you can correct me.
No, you're right. But, like it's like a missed opportunity. Like you've got an opportunity to discover some stuff about yourself that you cannot discover any other way. So you're right. You whether you're stifling it on purpose or by accident, either way, you've left the door closed that you could open and find out what's in that room. And you don't have to do ridiculous stuff. Like it's contextual. Like you don't have to do 500 miles and 400 miles in the Arctic. Like for some people, it might be, I want to do park running. I'm a 5K run with my kids, or I want to learn to swim in the ocean, or I'm going to be one of these cold plunge people, or I'm going to, you know, write a book or what, you know, whatever discomfort it is for you that you're going to do, that is the opportunity for growth. Growth never comes through comfort. just the system doesn't work that way. Nature doesn't work that way. Like everything is, we test it till it breaks. And if it didn't break, it works and we keep it. And then we test it again until it breaks. And if it doesn't break, we keep it. And we just, that's how the whole thing works. So I think we've forgotten that. That's how the system works. And you can leverage that and get a lot of value out of that. But the opposite is true as well. If you just stick with the tiny little circle of this is where I'm comfortable and safe, and that's a valid choice. You're entitled to make that choice. It's your life. Deal with it any way you want. But you can't then complain that you didn't get a chance to do all the other stuff or find out those other things that other people are doing. Well, that's their choice. They wanted that discomfort. They've made that choice to do that and reap whatever they've sown in that event.
I do. I wonder if, you know, following along that thread, if it, you know, humans trending towards not, you know, those missed opportunities or missing those opportunities, if that will stifle our progress as a species as well. Like it's, you know, I've thought about this a lot in the, obviously AI is in the zeitgeist right now, but I'm a software developer as well. So like it comes up in there a lot. It comes up in sometimes in these conversations. And that is also another area where I'm very intentional. I do use AI, these different LLMs for things, but I'm very deliberate when and how I use them so that I'm not offloading cognitive loads onto them. I'm using it for, okay, I need to perform this purely administrative task. You can do it in 30 seconds as opposed to this will take me an hour. I use it as a productivity tool, not a thinking tool, because I think, and there's been studies that have come out about college students using these things to write essays, and it like measurably in a relatively short amount of time decreases their ability to think critically. And I think that is a long, you know, it's at least parallel to what we're talking about here. And I think those things together, like our own technological developments, allowing us to not physically be pressed for challenge. And now we're having it cognitive wise as well. Like if we are going to over time degrade, and I mean the outside of the tinfoil hat of the super intelligent AI is going to kill people. I guess tinfoil hat's not the right word there, but you know what I like, taking that down the extreme.
I know what you mean, yeah.
But it's just, I don't have you. Actually, probably shouldn't drag you down that rabbit hole more, because I didn't want to be able to talk to you more about your stuff.
Well, but there's a good parallel. Like I'm sitting here listening, like there's a really good parallel in that, because like you take the college student thing where the AI has taken the value of the process out. Like when you write an assignment at high school, right? No one's ever going to reread that. No one's keeping it. Like you write that essay for your history teacher or whatever, they'll read it, put a mark on it, and then put it in the bin. But no one's ever reading that. The point of the exercise was the work you put in to produce the outcome, to produce the essay. The essay is actually irrelevant. The value is in learning how to learn and how to construct an argument. And if you're using AI to do that middle bit, you've actually lost the value. You thought the important part, not you, but you know, people thought the important part was producing the essay. It's not. The important part was the process of producing the essay. So to bring it back to the philosophical thing, I was thinking about why you were saying that. Like psychologist Carl Jung said, you know, beware the unearned wisdom. Beware of people who have got their knowledge from someone else. They haven't actually earned it. And the modern kind of version of that is beware the unearned dopamine. Like if you get your dopamine from just scrolling social media and finding the shortest, quickest route to get the outcome, you didn't actually earn it. But be wary of the people who've gone out and worked really hard to get their dopamine from understanding the process and love the process. Like people like me, when I go to these races, I find so much enjoyment and fulfillment in the process of preparing and then executing that I don't actually care about the outcome as much. Makes people like me very, very hard to beat, because I love the deal, the being in it so much that's my happy place, that I'm not hung up and panicking about the end outcome. If you love the process and earning that dopamine or earning that wisdom, you become very, very difficult to beat, versus the alternative going, if you always look for the quick version and you've skipped the work part, you never actually learn. You misattributed where the value is. You thought it was in the winning or the essay or the final report, or the value is actually in the work. And when you realize that, work becomes amazing to you because it unlocks. That's where all the unlocks are. That's where all the value is. So all of a sudden you begin to love the work. And when you love the work, you are basically unstoppable.
And I think it's important if people, what you are saying isn't you have to love, well, I guess, no, that doesn't extrapolate to that. I was going to say, like, you don't always have to love what you're doing necessarily, but you could find things about it to love.
Yeah, you can understand, yeah. Like being at school. No one loves being at school that much, but you're learning to learn, and the value is in the learning. You may not enjoy the process that much, but the skill, if you can learn to love that process, you know, you will extract a lot more out of it than a lot of other people will. So it doesn't always mean it's fun or enjoyable. Like, you still, the work is difficult, and the harder the work, often the greater the value, not always, but generally. So if you can learn to love that and see the value where it actually is, you don't kind of get lost and in the weeds looking for the shortcuts. I always say to people, doing the work is the shortcut. That is the shortcut. While people are looking for the quick way around, I just do it. Just do the thing. And then you're done and you've moved on while someone's still trying to figure out the quickest way to do it. You've just done it and you've moved on.
And you get more value out of that and figuring your way through it. I was curious about this when you were talking earlier, and then also just in that, your last point, and kind of as you qualified what you were saying, do you still get enjoyment out of less complex? Like, if you were to go do a normal marathon, which I don't even know if you've ever done a normal marathon, but is that too, from a logistic standpoint, is that too simple for you to get enjoyment out of it at this point?
No, I love those events. I love them all. Like, and they're all hard. Like, you do a 50 kilometer race, if you do a 50 miler or a 100 miler, like, they're all hard. They're all complex. And there'll always be a moment in the event where you hate everything and you want to quit. And that's normal. And part of it is, I enjoy going through that mental process of going, we knew we would arrive at a point in this event where you desperately wanted to quit, and we have arrived. Here is that point. And now we need to deal with those feelings, and we can accept them and roll them around in your head, and you can have your little cry or do whatever you got to do, and then keep moving forward and get the job done. So now I can find, and look, there was a period of time only a few years ago where I really struggled to find enjoyment in any of them. Didn't matter whether it was 5 kilometers or 500. Like, I really kind of lost my way for a while there of understanding why you do those things. And now that I reflect back, I think the difficulty I found was I got hung up on the winning, on the outcome, and I lost the enjoyment of the process. And it took me a while to kind of work through that and come back to the joy of the process versus the joy of the outcome. And once you get back to that place, you know, and for me, what I did was actually I just downgraded a bunch of races. Like, I'd signed up for a couple of 100 milers, and I downgraded them to half the distance, just did the 50K or the 50 miler, and went, your goal is to go out and enjoy this experience. Who cares? Dead last, doesn't matter. Your job, just go out and enjoy it and be appreciative of the fact that you are in a state physically and mentally where you get to do these things. So I went back to first principles and found the joy in the event again, and the joy in the preparation again, and then got myself back to a place where you can go and execute at a higher level again. But, you know, even for people like me, it's easy for people to look from the outside in and go, well, he obviously, you know, he's at that level where it's all about, you know, winning and being at the top end and got the capacity. Like, well, no, I still really struggle sometimes. And most days I'm not excited about training. And most events I find a point where I hate it and I question my existence and what's wrong with me and why do I keep signing up for these damn things. But that's part of the human experience of doing it. If it was easy and it was all sunshine and rainbows and Skittles the whole way, I wouldn't do it, because you wouldn't be getting out of it what you went to find in the first place. I went there to find out about myself, to find out who I am. And to do that, it needs to be hard enough to put you all the way down the bottom of the well. So if you want to find out those things, this is the price of admission. Pay it or don't.
I think that perspective, that when people take that route, or pose things as being, oh, because Paul, you're at the top of the game right now, you're winning these things, like that it must always be easy for you. I think that is an unconscious thing that people do to diminish the accomplishments of someone else. And maybe, I don't know if that is because of it being threatening or it making it so that then you don't feel that twinge of, well, how come you don't push yourself to get to that point? Or, you know, it makes it so that it seems like, oh, it's that thing that we do of other people where you're like, oh no, he's a different thing than me, and maybe always has been, or because like we are not the same thing. Whereas like people can push themselves. I obviously, not many people can push themselves to the point that you have, because that's why there's not many people that have achieved something like you have. But we are, you know, assuming that your body is you don't have some disability that prevents you from being able to do so. Like we are all capable of theoretically capable of reaching that level of just disgusting discipline and drive that you have. You see that a lot, even with lesser accomplishments that people do, whether it's not to the extent of propping you or that a person who's achieved something great as being a different thing. We see it in smaller levels of accomplishments. Well, it's, you know, he achieved X, but look at the, you know, Y and Z things that he had. Before he got this job before he became a CEO, well, he knew someone that gave him the team lead job before that, or whatever it was, this high level management position. And people, I don't know why we're shitty and we do that. Like we're trying to like pick things apart. I think it's a comfort thing.
I think it's a comfort thing. It makes me feel better about me if there's something that you have that I don't, which justifies why I can't do or won't do what you've done. And I talk about this speaking circuit. Like I talked about when you see me, like I'm short. I've got really thick glasses. Like I always joke that I'm a below average height, work from home dad from a country town with really bad eyesight. I'm like, I'm not an astronaut. I'm not an Olympian. I'm not an elite anything. Like if you put me in a lab and ran all the tests, my VO2 max would be average. Like I'm just normal. I'm just average. And it allows people to then kind of disrobe some of the argument of going, well, he did that because he's an Olympian. And he's got long legs or he's got a genetic gift. Like, no, I don't have any of that stuff. I'm actually pathologically, stunningly normal, which then allows us to have a conversation of going, well, why, if I'm normal and you're normal, that we don't have the argument of going, well, he's an Olympian and I'm not, so I don't have to worry about it. No, I'm normal, just like you. So what could you do as a similarly normal person? And we start to unpack the tools, because all of the things we've talked about today in terms of like the discipline and the mental skills and how you pack and how you execute and all those things. All of those are learned. All of those can be learned and they can be taught. They're skills. They're not gifts. And that's why, like, if I do a 50-mile or 100-mile race here in Australia at home, I'm middle of the pack guy every day because I'm not an elite runner in any way, shape, or form. The events that I've done really well in are because I will outwork people. It's because I'll out-execute. It's because I've got a plan and the discipline and how I approach it and the pre-work I've put in and all of the little 1%ers along the way. It's not because I turned up and I've got legs that are 6 foot long and I can just outstride you and, you know, I'm genetically better than you. So I think it's a really good point. And it's one of the things I try to disavow people of early. I am not elite. All the things I do are completely teachable. They're skills, and skills can be taught. And that's that thing between motivation and discipline. Motivation is a feeling. It's an emotion. It'll come, it'll go, it'll lie to you. Whereas discipline is a skill. You can teach it. You can build it. You can have it in the toolkit. You can rely on it. And that's why I think those kind of discussions around that are really, really important. But you're right, we do it because it makes us feel comfortable. You've got something I don't, which is why I didn't do what you did. I could do it if I had what you did. And then I go, well, you actually have what I have. So let's see what you can do.
Does that come up a lot? I mean, it is such a bitchy thing that we as humans do, and you have to be mindful of. If you catch yourself like thinking that way, you're like, no, I'm being a bitch. But does that come up with you a lot as you
That's
make
human.
It around?
I, okay. I do it myself. I look at people and go, well, they got a better score than me or a better outcome than me because they're better than me. And then you realize that you're doing the same thing that you tell everyone else not to do because yeah. you're just human. So it's not a
yes.
it's not a critique. When I say it to people, it's not like it's a criticism. It's just you're a human being and this is how we think and it's kind of shitty. So you need to then be kind of rise one level above that, top down and go, well, I'm not going to think like that because that doesn't serve me. Okay, so you kind of, you know, you can't outthink your way out of overthinking. Like it's sometimes you just need to go out and do some stuff and move and actually start doing things. And that helps you get a better understanding of what you're capable of versus sitting there in your own mind and just ruminating the daylights out of it about the reasons why you could do it, but you won't because of, you know, reason A, B, and C. So no, I think it's people are wired that way and I'm no different to them. And I do it just as much as anyone else does. I'm just over time, learnt to see it and then remind myself that it's a bullshit story that I'm telling myself and to throw it away and come at it from a different angle.
Yeah. And it's a totally natural way for us to think, but people do need to be mindful
absolutely.
Of it.
That's, yeah.
I'm trying to decide where I want to go with this. Cause there's so many things I want to ask you, but it's, you know, I told you probably take an hour and a half of your time. So I feel like,
throw some questions at me, man. It's all good.
Yeah. With now you going, it's Namibia that you're going to, right?
Yes. Yep.
Is this your first desert ultra? And if so, was that specifically to do something different, push yourself in a different way?
Yeah. Yes. And yes. So when I sat back, so one of the things is obviously I'm married, I've got kids. So when I'm training for these events and go and do these events, I get to get all the cool photos and post stuff on Instagram, yada, yada. But there's a bunch of people that don't, but they're making sacrifices. So my wife's got to juggle full-time work and two kids and my family's helping out and her family's helping out. So there's all these people making sacrifices behind the scenes and you have to respect that. So for me to go do another race in the Arctic or a cold weather race, I'm not going to learn anything about myself that I don't already know. Like I've kind of solved that equation. So why do you do these things? To learn about myself. Okay, well, if you're not going to learn any more about yourself, then you shouldn't do that. Where will I learn the most about myself? Well, you should do the absolute opposite. So I chose this race specifically for A, it's in the heat. I'm extremely good in the cold. So let's go somewhere where I lose that advantage because I will learn there. I am very good in single stage, super long events. This is a stage event so that I can't outwork people overnight, if that makes sense. Like you will run a set distance every day. So, and you'll sleep overnight like a normal person would in a tent in the desert, but you'll sleep every night. So I lose my biggest advantage. I'm not in the cold and we're not operating 24/7. So that now I have to learn about how well can I operate in that environment, which is totally different to what I've done before. Because I reckon I learned something about myself there. And now it becomes a worthwhile endeavor. It's worth my sacrifice of time, training, and effort. And it's worth me asking those around me to sacrifice something while I'm away to go do that kind of thing. And it's a different equation to solve. Like how you train for a very cold race is different. Vastly even how you train for an extremely hot race. So, and I find that fascinating to go, let's science the shit out of it. How do I prepare to run, you know, 50, anywhere between 50 and 90 kilometers a day for 5 days straight in 50 degree temperatures? Like, how am I going to figure that out? How do I deal with, what are the problems? How am I going to solve them? How do I deal with things when they come up? How am I going to keep a mind in the right place? And those kind of things. So I find that really, again, fascinating kind of problem to solve.
And that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about was how the hell you do prep for that stuff. But I was worried that might be a 20-minute answer that I'm like, because
no, I'll give you okay. a really short example of something I did this morning before I got on this podcast. So I did, you know, asterisks again, not health advice, don't do this. So I've got a sauna at home. So what I did is I've gutted the internals of the sauna so I could put an assault bike in there. So I've got like a stationary bike inside the sauna. And it's a hot rock sauna. So I can get the inside of the sauna to the exact conditions of the desert. I can get it to 50 degrees centigrade, about 15% humidity. So I then get in there and just pedal on my bike in that environment going, okay, it serves three purposes. One, physiologically, like I'm building heat shock proteins, your blood plasma changes, you're doing a lot of internal biomechanical stuff that's changing so you can kind of prep for the heat. Two, psychologically, it sucks. It's horrible. But I'm like, when you're in the desert, you can't just kick the door to the sauna open and cool down. Like if it's 50 and you're overheating or your heart rate's jacked or whatever, you have to deal with that. So psychologically, I'm spending time in there going, okay, we got to keep your heart rate under 150. So you got to breathe, calm mm-hmm. your brain, pause, take a rest, you know, chill, drink. Like what are the tips and tricks we're going to build so that when I'm out there in the desert and things are inevitably going to go wrong, your brain doesn't freak out, or it does freak out, but you go, yeah, we've done this. We've freaked out before. Can we remember what we do? We breathe, and this is how we breathe, and we rest a little bit, and we do this and we do that. And then also from a mathematical point of view, I do a weigh in and weigh out. So, okay, well, I know that if I pedal for an hour at 50 degrees in the sauna, I drop about a kilo and a half. So that's all fluid. So I know how much sodium I lose per liter because I did a sweat test. So now I know how much salt I need. So then I can plan my nutrition for the race to go, okay, you need to be getting this much sodium in every hour. So you can kind of start pre-solving some problems, because you're going to lose a ton of salt, which means you're going to cramp and screw your electrolytes, and that can be quite dangerous. So how do I solve that problem in advance? Know how much you lose. How much can I replace? How am I going to replace it? Make sure you've got that in the right spot on your packs. You can easily access it and do it. So you're doing all those things. So you just, again, what are the problems? How am I going to solve them? Train to solve them. Have the toolkit ready, and the toolkit has to be physical and mental and all that kind of stuff. So that's an example of how I'm kind of approaching this.
You are a freaking mad scientist. Just
I'm a nerd, man. I got the thick glasses on, man. This is how we do the things.
My naturally went to, I've been in the outback before. It's hot as shit there. Duh, that's he'll just run out there. But it's, do you know, I'm curious, I guess, did you get that idea from Laird Hamilton? Have you heard of him before?
I do know Laird Hamilton. I actually got it probably partially from just going, how am I going to prepare for this?
Yeah.
And kind of trying to figure it out. And then I follow David Roche, who's a big ultra runner in the US, and he was doing a lot of heat training. He was talking about the biological aspect of what it does in terms of your proteins and blood plasma and all these kind of things. I'm like, I like that approach. You're going, it's not a case of just get in the sauna and sweat and go hard. It's like, well, that doesn't solve anything. Like, it must have a purpose. Don't just go out and do hard things. I have a purpose behind why you're doing them and what you expect to get out of them. So that when I'm in that sauna doing that, there really is a clear purpose. And there's also a guideline for going, okay, if your heart rate's way too high, this isn't helping you. It's actually probably wiping you out. You're not going to be able to train tomorrow, and this is probably dumb. Versus, here's the band we want to operate in, and this is why we want to operate in that band, and how we're going to measure these things so that it has value. It's not just mindless suffering for the point of trying to be a hero. There's a lot of science around it, and seeing people who have done some of this stuff well before me. And like, I wasn't joking, like, you know, asterisk, don't do this at home. Like, I've spent a long time studying and learning about these things, and I'm very intentional about how I do it and why I do it. And there can be quite a danger to just go, oh, I'll just get in the sauna and just run like an idiot. Like, don't train in the sauna unless you really, really understand what, why, and how. Otherwise, it can be really dangerous and really stupid. That's just, you've got to be very intentional and smart about how you do these things. And I should point out, this is pre-race. I might get to the end of the race and go, hey, the bike and the sauna thing did not work. I might come up and go, don't do that. It's a total waste of time.
Well, it sounds good though when you're like, I know how much salt is in my sweat. I know how much I sweat there. It makes, so at least at least it sounds good. Yeah.
The theory is good. Sure, it can't hurt. Yeah. I'm just hoping that I get out there on day one and it's absolutely cooking and I'm going, gee, I'm glad I did all that sauna work versus that was so pointless. This is horrible. Well, you know, I'm going to learn, but that's the point. I'm going to learn. We're going to find out. I will know more. No matter the outcome, I will come home more knowledgeable than when I went there.
Yeah. If this is something you don't want to answer, obviously tell me to fuck off, but I was wondering when, you know, I've gotten the insight, my friend Lonnie, who I mentioned earlier, I think some of the costs that I've known go into these mountaineering trips are some of it's, you know, obviously just doing like Everest is an ungodly expensive trip, but he's done all these trips. Mm. I don't know how much of these costs are also because he is totally blind. And so he has to have support with him as well.
Yeah.
But you know, it is incredibly cost prohibitive. So I guess it came up first when you were talking about the mountaineering stuff. Then I've wondered with these races too, like getting all of your gear over to Namibia for this and whatever other preparations, all that takes, like this has to be incredibly expensive. Were you funding all of this just through your businesses?
Yeah, I just funded through, like, you know, I want to live my life. So, you know, I've always said that the goal, in my mind, the goal isn't to work your ass off until you're 65, retire and hope that you've got enough money and your knees still work and you can go do the things you want to do. Like, it's too late. You missed six decades. So my theory is you should be writing chapters of your life all the time. So I wanted to go out and live. So I have worked very hard. I've been very successful in business. I still work very hard now. And I use a portion of that to go out and do the things I want to do while I'm still fortunate enough to do them. Like, my body works. Like, yes, I'm not a leap, you know, but my legs work, my arms work, my brain work, everything works. So how dare I not go out and use that to do as much as I can? Because there are plenty of people who would give anything to be in that position to be able to do that. In terms of the cost, yeah, again, it's that long arc thing. Like, you build the equipment over time. So once you've got enough gear to do a certain number of mountains, you've got enough gear to do all the mountains. You've built that backlog. And then when you go to do the Arctic Ultras and stuff, now, I had 75% of the gear because I'd had it from mountaineering. You've kind of built the experience and the equipment. Mountaineering can be very expensive depending on where you're going. Like, getting to the Antarctic is really bloody expensive. But then some of the stuff in the Himalayas is not. And in terms of these events, they're not as expensive as you'd think. And when you look at it, like, from a race director point of view, most of these people do it because they love it. They're not trying to make millions out of running the race. And you take it, like the 6633 as an example. What do they provide? Well, you turn up, there's no accommodation because you're sleeping in a bivy bag. You bring all your own food, all your own equipment. You are your own transport. So from a, like, there's actually the race directors are going to go, we need to have permits to do everything. We need a medical crew on standby that kind of are going from first to last and keeping an eye on people and some logistics around it. And that's it, because you brought your own food, your own mobile hotel, and you're kind of self-sufficient. So most of these events, you know, the entry fee is normally in the range of $3,000 to $5,000, somewhere there, give or take.
Okay.
And you've got to get your ass to wherever you got to get to, depending on where that is. And that's it. And if you've got none of the equipment, then yeah, can add up quite quickly. But if you've already got a big, like, I've got a shed just chock-a-block full of equipment, but it's taken me 25 years to put that together. So yeah. I can go in and go, like, even this race in Namibia, like, I need freeze-dried meals to eat. I went into the shed and went, well, I've got a whole box of those left over from the last race. So we'll just grab what flavors we want. We've already got them. So you end up having a lot of this stuff by iteration over time. There are costs involved, but if you're prepared to look at it over the long arc, you kind of amortize it over quite a period of time. And, you know, what are you saving it for? Like, you know, your ticket could be up tomorrow. So don't be silly, but by the same token, your job's to live and to do the things and write your story. So sometimes you should take a portion of the hard-earned stuff and go do the thing you want to do sooner rather than later, because you're not guaranteed a later.
No, I love that. And it's just, I know you've had a couple different businesses too. And I think that makes it more badass that, like, all right, obviously you're kicking ass with the races and all that stuff, but you've also, as an entrepreneur, reached a point like where you're able to do all this. So I just, it's another layer of the impressiveness. And it's so cool to me. I hadn't thought about the accumulation of all that stuff. It's just, all of it is freaking fascinating, I guess. Last thing I want to drag you into here, because I'm just curious. I've always, as an entrepreneur, I've thought that owning a gym or a CrossFit box at some point would just, that's a freaking cool business to have. Like, with you, I know, so you ran a CrossFit box. Did that stop because of COVID? Is that, like, was that because you couldn't do in-person stuff or what?
This is the funny story. So I never intended to own a CrossFit gym at all. I'm a nerd. Okay. Nerds don't own gyms. That's not how it works. So I'd reached a point in my mountaineering career where I'd signed up to, I was going to do an Everest expedition. Like I'd done everything else and that was all that was left. I've never climbed Everest, by the way, you know, spoiler alert. And I was training at a local gym. And the trainer that I had there, the PT, she was like, look, for what you want to do, I really think traditional gym training isn't for you. If you looked at kind of functional fitness, if you look at CrossFit, never heard of it, don't know what it is. So I looked into it. There was a CrossFit gym in town where I live. So I went and joined it. Went, this is awesome. And then because I'm a serial, you know, entrepreneur and can't help myself, I said to the guy that owned it, hey, look, you're really good at marketing. I'm really good at kind of, you know, processing that. Have you thought about having a partner? He's like, no, but yeah, okay. So I bought half the gym. Just because I can't help myself. And then a little while later, he went, oh, I'm going to move back to my hometown because my wife wants to move back there, yada, yada. Can you buy me out? Like, yeah, sure. Okay, I'll buy you out. And then I realized that I own a full CrossFit gym now. And then I'm like, okay, well, I own the gym, but I'm an entrepreneur, which means I don't like spending money, but I've got to keep fitting this thing out because it was growing. I don't want to pay full retail for gym equipment. How do the big guys do it? Well, they import their own gym equipment direct. Okay, well, could I do that? So I don't know. Well, how do you find out? Well, you just try. So I made a few phone calls and like 2 weeks later, I was in Shanghai with an agent going out to warehouses in Shanghai going, can you guys build stuff? Can we make some, can you design a GHD for me and barbells and bumper plates? And then, so I got a shipping container in of equipment, but then word gets out. I had a couple of mates ring me and go, hey, I heard you're getting shipping. You're bringing in equipment like at non-retail, like cost. Can we get some? Yeah, sure. And then a few more people ring. And then you start getting more and more shipping containers in. And then I'm like, well, shit, I might as well set up a website. So I set up a website and then started selling, retailing, and shipping gym equipment all over Australia by accident. Because I'm like, well, now I've got all this stuff, so I might as well get a warehouse and a forklift and start selling this shit. So now I went from I want to climb Everest to I own a CrossFit gym and have a full-time business running that and shipping and importing gym equipment. And I owned that for about 7 years. I never climbed Everest. I ended up selling the business through sheer luck about 2 years before COVID hit. I just went, I've just had enough. Like, you know, running a gym like that, it's early mornings and it's late nights and it's hard work and all that kind of stuff. We have kids. I'm like, I'm just going to sell it. And I ended up selling the business and I sold the business to the PT who first trained me in the very first gym originally and said, you should look into CrossFit. And she ended up joining the gym, became a trainer, became one of our head coaches, and then bought me out at the end of the journey, which I kind of loved. I don't know whether the universe did that on purpose or not.
That's cartoonish.
Kind of closed the circuit. Yeah, kind of closed the circuit. So I did that and I closed the business of selling gym equipment because I'm like, I'm not in the space as much anymore. But it was just a very weird arc of my life where I just went, can I do that? I don't know. We'll just find out and we'll try. And you end up doing just the weirdest stuff because you just went, let's try it and see what happens. And next thing you know, you're in a warehouse in Shanghai trying to, you know, design gym equipment and figuring out how to import container loads of stuff into the country and selling it. So yeah, that's my CrossFit gym story. I don't know. It just happened.
It is like for a side quest, that's a really cool side quest to go on.
That's a good side quest.
Yeah. So, and you'll still be able to do Everest should you so choose. So, gosh,
I have no desire to climb Everest, by the way.
No.
None whatsoever. I just think the value is not there for me. There's so many people there who shouldn't be there. As a purist, I have a really silly view that I'm kind of the Mesner view that if you're going to climb a mountain, you should climb it without oxygen and you should climb it as it is. And I know that I am not physically capable of climbing Everest without oxygen. Like there's 0.001% of the population that can do that. So I don't want to do it. I'm just like, for me, I'd be doing it. I'd be climbing a version of it. Now I'm not dissing people who have done it with oxygen. Like you do your journey your way. But for me, I would feel that I climbed a version of it, not it as it stands. So I'm like, you know what? I've never used oxygen on any of my climbs. I've always carried my own gear. It's because I just want to do it old school way. And that means that there's a ceiling of what I'm capable of. And I'm quite happy to accept that.
That's a very reasonable way to look at that. I'm sure you're probably not alone in that. And yeah, you know, in the realm of other mountaineers, I'm sure there's gotta be, it makes sense when you lay it out like that.
Yeah, there's schools of thought around it. And like I found once you got high enough up into the kind of the mountaineering expedition kind of world and you were climbing with people who climbed a lot, most people didn't give a shit about Everest. Like the people who do this a lot are like, no one cares. There's so much other cool stuff that's really hard and technical and relatively untouched that there is the value of the experience in that the commercialized stuff has kind of lost some value in it. And that's not to denigrate anyone who wants to do that stuff. Like I've done a lot of the commercial stuff and that's absolutely valid. If that's what you want, that's fine. But for my metrics, this is what I want. And that's kind of the lane that I like to play in. And that helps me sleep at night and look myself in the mirror and go, yeah, I got as far as I could go with the metrics that I want to abide by.
That's beautiful, man. There's a lot of golden nuggets in this conversation for people to dig out. But is there anything that like you typically try and plant a seed with people with or that you typically use to try and plant a seed in people or that we haven't discussed that you would like to before we wrap this thing up?
No, I think I enjoy it. Like you said, I love the fact that you don't send questions. We have a conversation and we go where it goes. And I find that's really enjoyable for me as a guest because you just go down all these rabbit holes that are of value to your audience and you. And, you know, we get to uncover some really cool stuff. It's the only thing I talk to people a lot is about having a map and a story. Like you want to get the biggest map possible as to what is available to you to experience in your life. And the way you do that is you need to constantly get to the edge of your map and get off it. So you need to constantly do things that allow you to expand that map as to what possibilities are available to you. And then you use that map to write your story. And it's your story. So you're the director, producer, you're the star, you're the main character, you're everything. So rather than let it happen to you, take charge and write your story. Like go out and do things. They won't always win. They won't always be successful. They won't always be funny. They won't always be fun, but they're still part of your story. And they're the things that you share with your loved ones and your kids and you reminisce about and that kind of stuff. So get the biggest map you can, get off the edge of it as often as you can and proactively write your story every single day. Do that. And I think that's how you have a life worth living. There you go. That's it.
You've definitely done that. Do you have plans to literally write that story down?
I've written one book. I wrote Lost and Found, which was the story of the 6633, my two attempts at that. So the failure and then the win. And I'm writing a second book at the moment, very slowly, that is about how to do hard things. So it's kind of a blend of Eastern philosophy and how do we do hard things? And the fact that there's often quite a blend between the two in terms of how do you approach these things mentally and physically and, you know, spiritually, if that's your thing, or philosophically, if that's your thing. So I'm currently wrestling with that and trying to get it on paper. It's winning currently. I'm not, but we'll get there.
You'll have to let me know when it's out. So
I'll send you a copy, Matt.
I want to hear how
it gets finished.
I want to hear how Namibia goes too. So you'll have to send me an email when you're all wrapped up with that. But thank you so much for coming on. If people want to hear you speak, where can they contact you at?
Yeah, pretty simple. Just paulwatkins.com.au. That's my website. And then it'll direct you. You'll find me on LinkedIn. You'll find me on Instagram. Like that'll direct you to all the socials and that kind of stuff. You can find me on Substack under Paul Watkins as well if you want to read some of the stuff I write. But yeah, either one of those will point you in all the right directions.
Awesome, man. Well, stay in touch. You got my contact info. So thanks again for coming on.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate you giving me the time and the platform and the space. And I love the conversation, man. It was awesome.
Awesome. Thanks everyone at home for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Just, you know, this conversation was full of so many nuggets of food for thought that you need to take some time and think about and share this thing around. Cause I think there's, again, people need to hear these conversations. This was a standout one. Remember to leave a rating and review wherever you're listening. And if you want to start watching these things, check us out on YouTube. I'll see you next time.